Welcome to Statewide, reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up this hour, mask requirements are being loosened a bit with more people being vaccinated, but will it be so easy to shed the mask? Not everyone plans to do so. We'll hear more. The State of Sound is a new exhibit at the Presidential Museum in Springfield that features musical artists with ties to Illinois.
We look for people that were really important to the music, of the landscape of music globally and internationally. We also look for ones that made Illinois their sort of professional home for long periods of time, whether they were born here or not.
We'll also hear from the leading Democrat and Republican in the Illinois Senate as the legislature tries to wrap up its spring session and pass a budget. We'll also talk with the woman who writes the checks for the state of Illinois. That's all ahead this hour on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a conversation with the Illinois Comptroller, Susanna Mendoza. We'll also hear from the top Democrat and Republican in the Illinois Senate as lawmakers work on a budget. And mask requirements are being lessened. More people are getting vaccinated. Not everyone, though, is ready to give up the mask. Those stories and more on the way. Well, COVID vaccines are getting into more arms across the state, but there still remains a persistent problem, a big discrepancy among whites and blacks. Yvonne Booz has more.
About 65% of Illinoisans who are fully vaccinated are white. That tracks pretty closely with their share of the state's overall population. Blacks, on the other hand, make up close to 15% of the state's residents, but account for less than 9% of those who are fully vaccinated. That's about half of what you'd expect just based on demographics. Some say that's because Blacks are more reluctant to get the shots. Chandra Loggins Clay is an assistant professor in the College of Interdisciplinary Health Professions at Northern Illinois University. She says vaccine hesitancy isn't unique to the Black community, but there is more skepticism from this group.
Because of the historical context and the larger issues that we see in the healthcare system today, such as like the inequities and health disparities in health and health outcomes.
She says some people of color have mistrust because of things like the Tuskegee experiment, where Black men were allowed to suffer and even die from syphilis, a treatable disease, to satisfy the curiosity of white medical researchers. There's also the Henrietta Lacks story. Lacks died from cervical cancer, but her cancerous cells were used for research without her permission. Clay says that addressing this hesitancy is all about the messaging and not so much about trying to convince people to take the vaccine. Cordell Hunter is a Black Northern Illinois entrepreneur. He is against taking the vaccine. He says he doesn't trust it because of systemic racism.
I believe that a white person would believe the government before. I mean, they have more reason to believe than I do. So it's like they didn't pick a group of white folks to experiment with.
Joe Grissom III is the chairman of Aurora Housing Authority Board of Commissions. He's also Black. He says when he first heard about the vaccine, he wasn't anxious about getting it right away. He originally decided to revisit the notion once summer hit.
I think it was a combination of things. It was a little bit of mistrust or distrust. But then also, the name for me just bothered me, the Operation Warp Speed.
Grissom says he also thought about the Tuskegee experiment, but the more research he did, the closer he came to a decision.
I talked to a plethora of friends. I get friends that are, you know, in the health field, from pharmaceutical sales to pharmacists to doctors, you name it. It wasn't until I talked to all of them and got their reassurance that I felt there was a level of comfort.
He says another factor that swayed him was the fact that a few people close to him contracted COVID-19 and passed away. But he says the major deciding factor was his own underlying health condition. Grissom also says his wife showed him information about immunologist Kizmikia Corbett, and knowing that a Black woman was a part of creating the Moderna vaccine gave him reassurance. But Hunter says this fact doesn't change his view.
I mean, they always got somebody with a Black face to make announcements or ease the pain.
Hunter says he doesn't think he will ever get the vaccine. In addition to his prior mistrust, he says a family member passed away a couple of days after taking her first shot. Grissom received the Moderna vaccine earlier this year. Clay says everyone should do their research to decide what's best for them. She recommends talking to your healthcare provider or visiting the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention website for accurate data.
And so after you do your research, look within yourself and say, is this something that I really want to do? And what are my reasons for doing it?
She says we can't discard the mistrust that some Black Americans have, but forcing trust isn't going to solve the issue. She suggests that working on the system that may have caused this mistrust can be the beginning of the solution. She mentions that things like improving vaccine accessibility, equitable distribution, and having cultural competence trainings for those who provide health care to Black Americans would be a great starting point. I'm Yvonne Booz.
Phone, wallet, keys, mask, it's a checklist ingrained in our minds these days when we leave the house. But mask restrictions are beginning to loosen. Vaccinated Illinoisans are no longer required to wear them outdoors or inside around other vaccinated people. While shedding the mask might be easy for some, others remain hesitant. And from Chicago, Mariah Wolfel talked with some residents about how masks fit into their future.
Picture this, abandoned masks rolling through the streets like tumbleweed. That's the post-pandemic future Chicagoan Aisha Romer imagines.
It's going to be a lot of masks just like blowing through the wind. And like just the thought of like walking somewhere and then like a mask just hits you in the face. Or like just seeing a mask hanging in the tree and then be like, I hope it doesn't fall on me.
Romer says her allergies weren't as severe this year because of masking. Still, she thinks the practice will die down within a year or two. But if some Chicagoans have it their way, masks will stay relevant, nice and safe on the hook or bin where you store them, ready for action.
I don't see why I wouldn't, like during flu season, wear a mask on occasion if I'm worried about it.
I could see wearing a mask on the plane all the time, even though I hate it.
I thought it was an asset when I went to the eye doctor. So did she. You know how close you have to get, bad breath and whatnot. Mask is a good thing, I think.
They were already a common thing in other parts of the world.
Yeah, back in China, a lot of us wear masks just to protect ourselves.
Dr. Allison Arwady, the commissioner of the Chicago Department of Public Health, agrees. The U.S. has taken a page from the book of countries that have dealt with past epidemics.
In a lot of the Asian countries that had been hit harder with SARS and, you know, some of these others, there is much more of a culture of wearing a mask if I'm not feeling well or sometimes when I'm traveling. And I do think that at some level, we will see people continue to make that choice to wear a mask no matter what the government does.
Though she didn't commit to a specific policy, Arwady says masks could become a regular part of health prevention. The Illinois Department of Public Health said the same, and that masks could be recommended during future flu seasons. But not everyone is on board with the idea. This was clear when I asked Chicagoans on the street whether they think masks will continue to be part of everyday lives.
Come on. At a certain point, like, we all have to take a certain amount of risk just going outside.
Never even occurred to me that they might. I hope not.
And do you judge people who still wear their masks outside?
No. Okay. Well, no, I think they're kind of idiots, but...
Okay.
So, yes, he does judge them.
I believe that it's such a mistake that masks became a signal of political ideology.
Social psychologist Ayelette Fishbach works at the University of Chicago. She says masks may continue to cause division because people use them to communicate their beliefs.
It, on the one hand, makes no sense. On the other hand, as a psychologist, I understand that people use all kinds of things to signal their identity. Okay, they use colors. They certainly use words. What they wear. And then people said, okay, well, here's another thing that we can associate with our identity, wear in order to deliver a certain message.
Most people I talked to, though, expressed a desire for these judgments to subside. Romer, the Chicagoan with the fear of a mask flying into her face after the pandemic ends, put it plainly.
I mean, I think it was weird, like, whenever I see people, like, outside with masks on, but I'm just like, I'm not like, oh, why do you have on a mask?
Instead, she just assumes they feel safer that way. Or even more simply, maybe they just don't want pollen in their nose. And she says that's perfectly fine. Mariah Wolfel, WBEZ News.
Illinois' budget picture looks better than most predicted. That's thanks to a big influx of federal aid. Derek Cantu talked with the Illinois Comptroller, Susana Mendoza, about the state's financial outlook.
A couple weeks ago, your office reported that the state had reached this milestone, that our bill backlog had gone to just a little over $3 billion. We do have still some billions of dollars in debts or loans that we borrowed from the Federal Reserve. Reports are saying that for the FY22 budget, there might be $1.4 billion in a deficit. And of course, the graduated income tax did not pass last year. So is this just a temporary reprieve that we have right now?
I walked into an office under what seemed like impossible circumstances, and I am very happy and proud to report that we are in a situation today for the first time in many years where Illinois is able to pay all of its commercial vouchers within a couple days. We're not even at a 30-day cycle right now. We've gotten it down to within a few days, if not a day, of paying our bills. The important thing is that our new governor needs to champion a balanced budget coming into this next session. He, I think, has tried to do his best so far and has done a really good job. But we have to remember that if we don't get balanced budgets year after year, at least try our best to do that, the reality is that the fate of the bill backlog rests entirely, I would say, right now, since we have it under control right now, on whether or not we introduce and pass balanced budgets moving forward. We can't go back to the days of introducing budgets that are wildly out of balance, that have things like the grand bargain and working with the Senate as, you know, $3 or $5 billion line items on balancing a budget. Those days are over, and we do need to be very transparent with our budget processing and just show taxpayers that we're taking seriously the issue of being fiscally responsible and looking out for their tax dollars.
A couple months ago, CONGFA released a report, and one of the scenarios that they projected was if the state were to continue doing their five-year average of spending increases of about 2.7%, they projected by FY 2024, the bill backlog might go back up to $19 billion. How realistic is that scenario?
You've heard the governor present about $900 million worth of tax cuts on the incentives to large corporations. And I know that there's a lot of pushback on that, but the reality is that the corporations that he's targeting with those tax cuts fared incredibly well during the pandemic. I mean, this pandemic didn't affect everybody equally, right? The people who could least afford it took a massive hit. So if they look at a projected revenue deficit of $1.4 billion, I mean, right there, you could have $900 million that helps balance that out. And so they're gonna have to look at all areas, but I would say that where they can't afford to cut is in the areas that I've been prioritizing as controller, and that's human services, social services. The people who are fighting on the front lines of trying to keep people in their homes and healthy. And one thing we haven't even begun to talk about is what the financial fallout is going to be long-term when it comes to healthcare from the pandemic. I spend so much money on paying healthcare bills, I'm fearful of what lies ahead. So we have to approach every budget season moving forward. When you see new revenues, not automatically think about how you're gonna spend them, but how about we start talking about putting money away for a rainy day fund? We have less than 30 seconds worth of money, expenditures for daily operations in our rainy day fund right now. We haven't had, and I would say this in both parties, enough fiscal discipline. And I do think that that doesn't mean not paying for the things that we need, like, again, more money for education or for social services, but it's less money on wasteful things that aren't really moving the needle on improving people's lives.
Just last week, Governor Pritzker announced that he is actually committing to funding the $350 million for evidence-based model funding for FY22. Can we afford that? And do you also believe that Illinois will be on track of hitting this goal that was previously put out, that all school districts would hit 90% of their adequacy targets by 2027? Are we on track to hit that?
So I don't know if we're on track for that. I don't want to say one way or the other, honestly. I don't want to give you an opinion without having seen all the data and the estimates right now on that. But what I will tell you is that we will meet that obligation for that $350 million for education. Illinois is one of the states that chronically underinvests in our state education system. And so when I talk about making the best use of a dollar and having the best return on investment on that dollar, you're always going to do well if you invest in education in this state. And education is one of those things that over the long term creates a massive return on investment for our state. Once Illinois actually meets its obligation of properly funding education, then those will be the days that we start to see a less of a reliance on property taxes. Because right now, why are people's property taxes so high? You know, the state of Illinois isn't the one that sets your property tax rates. And I think a lot of people mistakenly believe that we're the ones who say what your property taxes should be, but that's not the case. It's the local municipalities that set your property tax levies. And the problem is that they have to keep going back to that well because the state is not meeting its obligation of properly funding schools. The day we do that, you're going to start to see people no longer need to rely on property tax increases.
Your office has one initiative, House Bill 571, which would call for municipalities to report more details about tax increment financing districts. Could you just first tell me a little bit about what that bill would accomplish? And also, because such a big portion of education dollars are wrapped up in property taxes, do you believe that school districts should have a say on whether a TIF is created in their district or whether or not their dollars should be allocated to go towards a TIF, especially since not all TIFs, you know, lead to a, you know, return on investment?
Well, I feel that transparency has been the hallmark of my administration. And I think that it's also the road to restoring trust in government. When people believe that all of the decisions related to their school district or in any environment, right, are done behind closed doors without input by the people that are actually toiling away at this endeavor, it creates distrust and animosity towards the process. What happens is that all of these dollars are being generated and districts are missing out on money because it's going to investments on potential job creation or economic development. But we've also seen that they're supposed to be going to blighted areas, and a lot of these TIF dollars are not in what we would consider by any stretch of the imagination blighted areas. The other issue with the TIFs is that, interestingly enough, the developers are the ones who choose the consultants who determine whether or not this TIF is meeting its expected goals or deliverables in a return on investment for those tax dollars, which is an inherent conflict of interest. So we decided to, at the very least, as part of our big reform here, is that the city would be responsible for choosing their consultant because they want somebody who will advocate for the city's position here, not the developer's position in this deal. Of course, the consultant's always going to say, this is going to pay off great in 10 years, and it usually never does, right? So moving forward, these TIFs will have a lot more transparency, and they're going to have to report to my office whether or not they've met their deliverables and what their expectations are for meeting them, their timeline. And most importantly, the city will now have a vested interest in choosing a consultant that will make sure that these deliverables are legitimate. And then that gives the constituency a much greater voice.
That's Illinois Comptroller Susana Mendoza speaking with Derek Cantu. And still ahead, we'll be talking with the top Democrat and Republican in the Illinois Senate. Still to come on Statewide. Welcome back to Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. Coming up, we'll hear from the top Democrat and Republican in the Illinois Senate. They talk to our State House editor. We'll listen to what they have to say. That's coming up. Another group of students at Rock Island High School signed letters of intent. But instead of athletes accepting college scholarships, this group promised to earn degrees in education. Herb Trix tells us more.
They were the first participants in Rock Island High School's education internship program. And coordinator Mike Mertel says the school district also promised to interview them for future teaching jobs when they're done with college. One of the goals is to diversify the staff.
You know, provide an opportunity or try and entice students that may not have thought of teaching as a career. Maybe they haven't had a teacher that looked like them or was from the same culture as them. Get them thinking about teaching so that they can be that teacher for the next generation of students.
The program also gives them real-world experience by having them work with teachers in the district, developing lesson plans and teaching. 21 students participated in the first year of the internship program at Rock Island High School. I'm Herb Trix.
A truly open seat election for Congress is relatively rare, and it tends to attract a lot of interest from ambitious politicians. Congresswoman Sherry Bustos' retirement creates a wide-open field in the 17th District next year. Tim Shelley tells us more.
After five terms in Congress, Democratic Representative Sherry Bustos surprised many political watchers with the announcement she won't run again next year. Bustos says the decision has nothing to do with upcoming redistricting or her narrower-than-projected win over Republican Esther Joy King last year.
It's a very personal decision. It's a family decision. This is a tough line of work on families.
Bustos' exit makes it more difficult for Democrats to hold on to the Northwestern Illinois district. It also affects the battle to keep the party's narrow House majority. Robin Johnson is a political scientist at Monmouth College. He says while Bustos is a Democrat, Her centrist voting record conforms with constituents in her swing district. Johnson says whoever runs should pay attention to that.
I think a candidate on the Democratic side with that kind of profile will have an advantage in a general election.
Bustos was among the handful of House Democrats able to win re-election in both 2016 and 2020 in a Trump-leaning district. Republicans quickly placed the 17th on their list of 2022 targets. It's not clear what kind of district the 17th will be next year after the once-a-decade redistricting. Bustos says it won't be easy for Republicans, and UMAPs might make it safer for a Democrat.
If we pick up more of the city of Peoria, if we pick up more of the city of Rockford in this congressional district, then it could lean more Democrat than it does right now. And so it just depends on what happens with redistricting, but it's not an easy district for anybody politically.
Illinois will lose one seat in the next reapportionment. 18th District Republican Congressman Darren LaHood says that presents an opportunity to reunite divided communities like Peoria and Rockford into single districts.
Peoria shouldn't be split, in my view. I think we should draw district lines along county lines and city lines. I think that makes a lot more sense. I think when you divide up communities, it adds to confusion on who their member of Congress is.
Bustos and LaHood's scenarios are not the only ones possible. Democrats in Springfield control redistricting. Billy Halstead is the chairman of the Peoria County Democratic Central Committee.
You know, we don't know if we're going to push the 18th farther south or east or where it's going to go. So I'm not sure. I mean, it just depends on where the boundaries are actually going to go.
Even with new maps in play, the race will attract significant bipartisan interest. And Monmouth College political scientist Robin Johnson says that also means national party involvement.
I think the race will probably attract quite a few candidates from both parties. Open seat elections usually do that.
Esther Joy King, the 2020 Republican candidate, declared her 2022 candidacy shortly after Bustos' retirement announcement. While she didn't respond to interview requests, King said in a statement announcing her own candidacy that the 17th Congressional District, quote, deserves so much better than what the liberal elites have been serving them up in Washington, end quote. Bustos says there's a lot of strong potential Democratic candidates in the wings. She says she'll support the party nominee. Some political observers say those who want to run face a difficult issue of timing. They might want to wait to get in to see the new district boundaries and whether those help. If they wait too long, though, they lose the opportunity to raise money, form a campaign organization, and gain support from party leaders. As for her own future, Bustos says she still has 20 months to figure it out. Over the past decades, she's gone from working as a journalist to healthcare to Congress.
I'm passionate. I'm high energy, and I want to use all that for something that I hope will be big and meaningful.
Bustos' term ends in January 2023. I'm Tim Shilley.
Illinois has seen a significant slowdown in COVID-19 vaccinations over the last month as the state's vaccine supply surpassed demand. To incentivize vaccine uptake, one state lawmaker wants to allow all Illinois bars the option to offer a free beer or other alcoholic beverage if a patron provides proof of vaccination. State Representative Mike Zaleski, a Democrat from Riverside, says it would be an extra nudge for people on the fence about getting their COVID shot.
I think we reached a point in the vaccination battle where we have to reach people that are vaccine hesitant. And I think that this is one way to do that. We're going to have to try to incentivize them as best we can.
New Jersey last week debuted its, quote, shot in a beer program, which partnered with breweries around that state, offering free beer to anyone who gets their first COVID shot during the month of May. Zaleski's proposal would last much longer. Bars would be able to offer a free beverage with COVID vaccine cards for up to 6 months. The Illinois Senate Republican leader Dan McConkie has only officially been on the job for about 4 months, but he says bold ideas will help take his small GOP caucus in a new direction after several years of losing seats to Democrats. McConkie spoke with our State House editor Hannah Meisel about his vision for righting Illinois' fiscal ship in a post-COVID-19 era.
Illinois has both massive pension debt and a long-running, ever-widening structural budget deficit. The governor campaigned hard on what he thought his solution was, a graduated income tax, but of course voters rejected that. Do you believe, though, that Illinois can cut its way out of our fiscal problems? Or are there any revenues, say expanding sales taxes to include services like many other states do, that you'd be willing to discuss after the economy stabilizes post-pandemic?
Well, the number one thing that we need to do is make Illinois a state where people are actually moving into the state again, right? We're the only state in the Midwest that has significant net out migration. The biggest thing that we can do to stabilize our state's finances is to get working people moving into the state again. There's a number of things that fit into that problem. You know, when I talk to people who tell me that they're leaving the state, a big driver of that is property taxes. And the legislature has failed in the last several years to put forward reasonable reforms to help get our property taxes under control. And this is part of this. This affects not just individual families. I mean, it's a significant issue with individual families. I mean, your property tax bill is likely to be three times what it'll be moving to another state. Go to Indiana, your similar value house is gonna have maybe a third, maybe even less in property tax value. And the big problem with property taxes is how regressive they are. And what I mean by that is, if you invent a new app for your smartphone this year and you make $1 million, you know, you're going to pay, let's say, $10,000 in property tax. You know, if you lose your job and make nothing, you pay $10,000 in property tax. You know, the fact that we're so heavily reliant on property taxes is really problematic for families because it's just there, regardless of how much money they make. It's particularly problematic for business, especially small businesses or new businesses or businesses that are struggling, right? Because you're not paying taxes based upon your profits or how much money is going through your business. You are basing it on the number of square feet that you have. I've talked to, you know, manufacturers who are going to Indiana to set up shop for a number of reasons, but not, you know, chief amongst those tends to be property taxes, because especially if you need a large footprint in order to have you need to have machines and so forth like that, and you're paying on a square foot basis, you are paying that property tax bill regardless of whether or not you're making any money. And as business owners know, often it takes sometimes several years of investment before you finally begin to turn a profit. That's why we need to fundamentally shift away from property tax, get real long-term fundamental property tax reform in place that I think is going to help in lots of other areas to get economic growth going again. And when you do that, then you're going to end up, I think, becoming that net migrator, that net attractor of people to the state, which is fundamentally necessary for getting our state's finances in general under control.
It's interesting that you bring that up, because Cook County Assessor Fritz Kagi, he has this bill that he's been pushing since even before he was sworn into office, this so-called data modernization bill that businesses, the assessor's office, could ask for basic information like the income and costs. You know, that would be then baked into the property tax calculation. His bill would make it automatic for Cook County, and then the other 101 counties could opt in. He says it would, you know, stabilize that process. Do you support that idea? Do you support that bill? Or do you think that, you know, there are some that say it goes too far in asking things of businesses?
So I do think that there is merit to the idea. I think there's some specifics that we'll obviously need to work out and everybody at the table at. But I think part of the driver that is kind of creating the unfortunate situation that we're in now is just how many properties in Cook County, often in the city of Chicago, that pay a fraction of what they are supposed to be paying in property taxes because they happen to hire the right property tax firm. Fundamentally, at the end of the day, I think we need to move away from property taxes as the primary form of taxation of our school districts and things in general, municipalities and so forth, and get it over to another system. It's going to be very, very hard to do, right? I mean, most states who have tried to do this, it's been hard to do it without just like hard caps that they put in place and then, you know, leaving the door open for then, you know, there'd be a municipality or school district to go elsewhere in order to get money. You're going to make people mad and upset when you kind of upset the apple cart in that way. But it's the kind of fundamental change that's necessary. I think that his proposal is trying to work within the current system, when I think we'd probably need to blow up the current system and get something else fundamentally redone.
Well, lots of folks on the Democratic side agree with you that property taxes are regressive, and their solution then is, well, then we have to equalize, and we would raise the income tax and then distribute it to municipalities, school districts, et cetera, more fairly.
So, I mean, this is something we need to sit down and work out, and it's not easy to do. I mean, New Jersey tried to do something along this line. Part of the failure in New Jersey was the fact that they didn't provide the appropriate curbs when they did restructure the system to prevent property taxes from going back up again over time. And so it actually didn't have fundamental change in the system. And I think one of the other issues that really plays into all of this is the issue of trust. I think that's a big reason as to why the graduated income tax did not pass this last year. I think that the public just fundamentally does not trust Springfield in general. And as a result of that lack of trust, coming up with a big idea of like, let's blow up the system and like restructure it, I think is going to have a hard sell just because of those longstanding kind of issues of corruption and self-dealing that have happened in this building, have happened in this town. And I think that, that's probably the necessary precursor to get to the point in which we need to have developed that faith and trust in the public so that we can get to the point in which the big ideas, right, that we need to embrace can actually get traction with the public. There's no silver bullet, and it's not an overnight process.
In 2013, which was a couple of years before you came to Springfield, the General Assembly passed a very contentious pension overhaul law that organized labor fought tooth and nail and eventually successfully got it overturned in the state Supreme Court when the justices unanimously said that the pension protection clause in the state's constitution is pretty ironclad. Like I said, you weren't around for that 2012-2013 pension fight, but do you agree with your counterpart, Leader Durkin, that lawmakers should give it another go with then Senate President John Cullerton's so-called consideration model, wherein labor would negotiate what kinds of cuts they might be willing to see? Or are you more of the mind that a constitutional amendment to revise the pension protection clause, however unrealistic that might be in the current political dynamic that we're living in, is the only way?
So I was driving down to Springfield here recently, and I stopped and I saw a friend on the way down. And we're in the driveway chatting, and his wife came out to talk, and she was a retired teacher. And, she was commenting on the fact that she said, you know what, I get 3% annual compounded cost of living adjustment. And she said, I don't want the COLA. She said, I don't need it, first of all, but what I would rather have is the security of knowing that the pension system is going to be able to be there long term. She said, because I don't have that assurance right now. So I do think that we should get to a position to where we have some sort of kind of negotiated settlement, which has happened in other states, that ends up in the position that long term makes sure that these pension promises will actually be there for people no matter what kind of happens.
We are now in the midst of a session where massive energy legislation is on the horizon, which would include stronger mandates on clean energy and possibly totally overhauling how Illinois gets its energy. You, of course, I should mention, are an energy consultant. Most folks who are at the table negotiating the energy bill, they share a goal of having 100% renewable energy by 2050. Is that a realistic goal?
I'm not an expert in kind of, I do think that we could get there by 2050. The question is whether or not we could actually do it with the technology we have now. I don't think so with the technology we have now. However, things like the efficacy of solar panels and, the increasing miniaturization of kind of nuclear power that may be able, there is technology that may be on the horizon within the next 10 or 20 years. You have, something the size of this desk that's able to run a city of 10,000 people, and, it's safe, clean energy with no emissions. These are the types of things that I think are coming. So I do think that in the next 30 years, getting to a goal like that will be possible. We just need to make sure that we have the appropriate flexibility that we're recognizing and able to bring on board the new technologies and utilize them in the most effective, efficient way possible when they come to fruition.
That's the Illinois Senate Republican leader Dan McConkie in a conversation with our State House editor, Hannah Meisel. And just ahead, we'll hear from the Illinois Senate President. Democrat Don Harmon will talk with us. That's coming up on Statewide. This is Statewide. I'm Sean Crawford. On the way, a new exhibit showcases musical artists from Illinois. We'll learn more. That's ahead. Well, there's been promising news lately about Illinois' better-than-expected financial picture more than a year into the COVID-19 pandemic recession. But that doesn't mean the state's budget woes have disappeared. Our State House editor Hannah Meisel spoke with the Illinois Senate President Don Harmon.
Illinois has both a massive pension debt and a long-running, ever-widening structural budget deficit. And leaders from both parties, to be clear, bear responsibility for that. Governor Pritzker campaigned hard on what he thought his solution was, a graduated income tax, but voters rejected that. And I should mention that back in 2014, you also pushed for a similar graduated income tax idea. You know, last month you told WCIA that while you still think a graduated income tax is the right solution, you don't think it should be pushed again. When might it be the right time? And what would have to happen first?
That's a good question. I do think that a progressive income tax is the right policy model. It's what the federal government has. It's what most other states have. We are in the clear minority with a flat tax, and it impedes our ability to enact smart, nimble tax policy. The voters rejected that, based in part on some faulty premises, but at the same time, that message was pretty clear to me. I don't think it's right for us to go back to the voters in this next election and say, why don't we try again? We're going to have some honest conversations with taxpayers and with businesses. If you want the level of government services that people seem to demand of the state, we're going to have to find a way to pay for it. None of these things are free. The roads don't get paved for free.
So when do you think then conditions might be right to go back to the taxpayers and ask? Would it require massive ethics reform to gain taxpayer trust back? Would it require giving businesses time to recover from the pandemic?
It's hard to look in a crystal ball and predict with confidence, but I think you've raised a lot of the issues. Getting past the pandemic, getting the economy stabilized and growing, restoring some confidence in Illinois government are all important ingredients in going back to the voters to say this is good policy.
In 2013, the General Assembly passed a very contentious pension overhaul law, as we all remember. Organized labor fought it and eventually got it overturned in the Illinois Supreme Court, where unanimously all the justices said our Constitution has this pension protection clause and it's pretty ironclad. Should the legislature try again to touch pension benefits? Do you think the only solution is just saying, okay, you know, this is what the Constitution says, we got to pay it? Or should we go back and try what then Senate President Cullerton had pushed at the time, this so-called consideration model? Or is a constitutional amendment, however unrealistic you think that might be, is that the only thing that would make a real change in what the state owes?
I am one of those who thinks a constitutional amendment would do nothing to erase the legacy debt. And I don't even think a constitutional amendment would change benefits for people participating in the system today. Those benefits are protected not only by the pension clause, but also by the contracts clause of the state constitution and the United States Constitution. So there are a lot of people who would like to wish away the Constitution when it's inconvenient. But the short answer is on the legacy debt, we're going to have to pay it. The consideration model that had been in play may have worked at the time, but in the face of a 7-0 Supreme Court decision that, as you said, pretty much closed the door on changing current benefits, it is ironclad. But also lost in this entire conversation is the enormous reform we enacted in 2010 to create a second tier of pension benefits for every public employee in the state hired after January 1st of 2011. A much reduced set of benefits, so low, in fact, Social Security may ding us and force us to raise some of those benefits. That saved the state in excess of $250 billion by the estimates I remember from the time, and it got almost no coverage in the press because it didn't take any pensions away from anyone who had them at the time. But that transition from a Tier 1 pension model to a Tier 2 pension model will solve this problem over time. It's just, it's a problem that took a century to get into this deeply, it's going to take decades to get out.
If we fast forward a couple of years, we think about the budget impasse. As it dragged on from 2015 to 2017, eventually the conversation, especially from Democrats, but also Republicans and the business community, it switched to, well, businesses, maybe they would care more about stability than whether their taxes are going to be 1 to 2 percentage points higher over the coming years. What they want is to be able to plan in multi-year as businesses do. Now, how does that argument square then with the fact that in 2019, Governor Pritzker and Democrats negotiated with Republicans and business on a slew of business tax credits, but now in 2021, the governor says the state can't afford them and wants to reverse things like the retail discount and manufacturer's purchase credit. How is that stability?
Well, I have said for 20 years that stability and predictability are the two most important things that state government can give to Illinois businesses. At the same time, there's an uncomfortable relationship between business and government, which is ironic because state government depends upon our businesses, but our businesses depend upon our government. No one likes to pay taxes, but the fact is if we're going to have the sort of economy we want, we have to raise enough revenue to pay for all those services that business depends upon. In terms of the loopholes and tax expenditures the governor's talked about, I would think that business would be eager to come to the Capitol to explain all of the benefits that those tax expenditures generate. It would be a great opportunity to advertise how those government policies are encouraging businesses and creating jobs. So I'm hoping that's the conversation we're going to have, where we'll invite businesses into the Capitol to testify and to tell their story about how these tax incentives have created jobs and put people to work. That's the best way to defend all of them. If those success stories don't exist, then I think we probably should be looking at those expenditures to see if they really are worth continuing.
Well, some of them had barely even begun, though. So
well,
how is that?
I think the one you're talking about is one that hasn't begun at all, and what the governor's proposed is delaying the start of it until we get our sea legs under us again coming out of the pandemic. We do that often. We delay, or we extend to sunset, or we come back and see if something's working. That's different from the long-standing tax policies that folks have proposed we disrupt. But look, there's nothing wrong with kicking the tires and saying, does this program work the way it is supposed to work? Is it creating jobs? Is it putting Illinois residents to work?
We are in the midst of a session where massive energy legislation is again on the table, which would include likely stronger mandates on clean energy and possibly totally overhauling the way in which Illinois gets its energy. But also, we see Exelon is threatening to close 2 nuclear plants. ComEd is now requesting a rate hike, and Ameren wants to get into the energy production business for the first time with solar. And, of course, retailers and manufacturers are a huge, huge user of energy. Their impact on the environment is pretty big footprint. But also, you know, whatever Springfield decides to coalesce around, they're going to bear a lot of the cost. And, of course, as climate change gets more and more urgent with each passing year, you know, businesses also want to be part of the solution. But how do you balance the need for cleaner energy with the increased cost to both customers and business, especially when businesses, they might say, well, we can pack up and we can go to a state with lower energy costs, but, you know, ostensibly dirtier energy?
Well, fortunately, for a long time, affordable, reliable energy has been a key competitive advantage in Illinois. And that is because of the baseload capacity we built up over the years. You have to remember that most of the baseload, including all of the nuclear plants, were initially financed by ratepayers. And when we deregulated that market, we did two things. We pushed the price of power generation down, which was a terrific advantage to Illinois businesses that consume power, but also undermined our ability to construct new baseload plants that contribute to the power grid. 20 years ago, when I was getting started in advocating for renewable energy, I was laughed at in the building. That was unrealistic and never going to happen. Today, renewable energy is a critical business in Illinois, and we are a leader in that space. And the cost of renewable energy has tumbled so low that it's a direct threat to Exelon's nuclear plants. It competes with those plants on price. So more so than most areas of policy, we really need to be looking at what does our grid look like in 10 years? What does it look like in 20 years? Where does the power come from? what plants roll off production, what's going to take their place. It is really important that we build that future. It's important that we recognize climate change and the fact that clean, renewable energy is part of the future, and we need to build that into our model. That doesn't mean Illinois can't continue to provide affordable, reliable energy. The source may be different. But I don't want us to be the next Texas where things blow up and we don't have any power and the prices go up 1,000%. We can thread that needle and make sure that we have clean, reliable energy at a reasonable price.
That's the Illinois Senate President, Democrat Don Harmon, in a conversation with our Statehouse editor, Hannah Meisel. You can find more of her interviews with all four legislative leaders. We have a link at statewideshow.com. That's Rockford's own Cheap Trick, one of the many musical artists with ties to Illinois. A new exhibit at the Abraham Lincoln Presidential Library and Museum highlights Illinois' connections to music legends. Mary Hansen visited the museum. She has this report.
In a corner of the gallery, a pillar announces the folk genre of the exhibit with a picture of the late John Prine. Next to it is a collection of trinkets and photos that Prine would bring up on stage.
He had like Archie comic books because they remind him of his childhood. He loved Chicago hot dogs, so he had like a fake hot dog somebody gave him. He had pictures of his family, you know.
Dave Hoekstra is a music writer in Chicago and wrote the text for the exhibit, including the label explaining Prine's antidote to stage fright.
It's one of my favorite things of the museum because it just brings so much humanity into him and shows what a warm and warm soul he has.
I'd like to stay, but I might have to go to start over again.
I like to keep that in the present tense.
Texas, or go to somewhere that I've never been.
Prine died last year from complications due to COVID-19, and his family lent the items to the State of Sound exhibit at the Presidential Library and Museum in Springfield. Hoekstra, who was the Chicago Sun-Times music columnist for decades, consulted on the showcase that highlights Illinois' connections to music legends.
You know, it has to be top-heavy because Chicago is such a cultural center. We also tried to, show representation from all over state.
That includes June Christie, who grew up in Decatur.
She is kind of a rags-to-riches story, I think. And she went out to and record for Capitol Records in kind of a jazzy, sultry pop voice.
Christie is featured in the jazz section of the exhibit, along with Miles Davis and the red trumpet he played in the 1980s, and Herbie Hancock, who lent a keyboard. And if you're looking for a connection between Abraham Lincoln and the exhibit, Ramsey Lewis offered scores and a program from his musical tribute to the 16th president that he premiered at Ravinia in Chicago. The clip is from a promotional video Lewis posted to YouTube. Lance Tozer is the exhibit director for the museum. He acknowledges they could have featured many more artists in the show. So how did they narrow the field?
We looked for people that were really important to the music, of the landscape of music globally and internationally. We also looked for ones that made Illinois their sort of professional home for long periods of time, whether they were born here or not.
It includes treasures from some of Illinois' best-known artists, a copy of gospel icon Mahalia Jackson's first album, a guitar from the band Cheap Trick, and an award commemorating REO Speedwagon's High Infidelity album, selling 10 million copies. Tozer said he tried to go beyond instruments and career milestones. When he approached artists such as the rapper and actor Common, here was his pitch.
We care about the patron experience. We care about telling this story as comprehensively as possible. And we are looking for artifacts that are going to touch people and have an impact on people.
Common, who was born in Chicago, offered the custom Prada suit that he wore for his performance at the Oscars of the song Glory from the soundtrack for the movie Selma. The exhibit is organized into 13 genres, from spiritual, folk, country, and blues, into disco, punk, and metal. A mic stand the band Ministry used while on tour is in the metal section.
It looks like an oversized syringe. It's made out of metal, and it has sort of a human skull as part of it as well. It is not for everybody.
Tozer says that's part of his hope, too, that people will be open to listening to different kinds of music Illinois has to offer.
So I really hope people sort of make these stronger connections to these artists and realize that they have a connection to them because
They're from Illinois.
You may hear more music from the exhibit as the museum is inviting radio stations from around the state to broadcast from a temporary studio set up for the show. The State of Sound is open from now through January 2022. I'm Mary Hansen.
That's all the time we have for Statewide. We'll be back next week with more reports and conversations from in and around Illinois. If you missed any of this week's episode or you want to hear it again, just head to our website, statewideshow.com. You can find all of our shows there. Also, our podcast is available through the NPR One app. And don't forget to like us on Facebook. I'm Sean Crawford. Statewide is a production of NPR Illinois with help from other Illinois Public Radio stations.